Santa Fe, New Mexico, November 15th, 1874. It was late, and but a single lamp burned in the window of the Loreto Academy of Our Lady of Light. Assistant Pastor Thomas Hayes was reading. Father Hayes went to the window and drew the curtain aside. At first, in the starlight, he could see only the riderless horse. But as his eyes grew accustomed to the darkness, he could see the body of a man on the ground. He hurried down the hall and knocked on the door of Father Augustine Truchard, the pastor.
Yes? What is it?
There's a man, a horseman, lying in the yard, Father Truchard, and he appears to be hurt.
Very well. Allow me time to dress. Perhaps you should awaken Mother Magdalene.
Father Hayes hurried to the opposite end of the building to Mother Magdalene's door.
Mother Magdalene, are you awake?
Yes, Father, I'm awake. What seems to be the trouble?
There's a man lying in the yard and he appears to be hurt. Father Truchard and I are going to bring him inside. Perhaps you should prepare to receive him.
Oh, very well. Bring him into the room that adjoins your study. I will be there.
The priests carried the unconscious Nathan into the room. Mother Magdalene and Sister Francisca spread a clean sheet over a couch and opened a medicine chest.
If you will leave him with us, we will do what we can.
I'll unsaddle and care for his horse. The animal is exhausted.
Father Truchard had seen gunshot wounds before, and the stranger had been shot twice. It would be a long night. Nathan suffered a raging fever for a day and a night. Mother Magdalene, Sister Lucia, Sister Rosanna, and Sister Francisca took turns looking after him. After the fever broke, he slept for another day before regaining consciousness.
Where am I?
In Santa Fe, at the Loreto Academy of Our Lady of Light. You have been here 3 days and two nights.
My name is Nathan Stone, and...
You are still very weak. Rest, and I will have one of the sisters bring you something to help you regain your strength.
Nathan was fed soup until he could take solid food. Nobody questioned him, and his gun belt, with its twin Colts, hung on the head of the bed. There in a corner was his Winchester and saddlebags. On his fifth day there, he'd begun to feel guilty, and he spoke to Mother Magdalene.
Ma'am, I'm obliged for all you've done. I owe all of you my life, and...
You owe us nothing. We have done no more than our duty. For what we have done unto the least of his, we have done unto him.
None of them would talk to him about what he considered his obligation. Eventually, it was Father Hayes who began spending some time with Nathan, inquiring about his travels and about the frontier. It was from Father Hayes that he learned about Santa Fe, the building of the Loreto Academy of Our Lady of Light, and of the adjoining Loreto Chapel.
The chapel was just completed last year. It's the first Gothic structure west of the Mississippi. When you're strong enough, I'll show you around.
Thank you. I'll look forward to it.
Perhaps tomorrow, then.
While Nathan appreciated what had been done for him by the sisters and the priests of Loreto Academy, he had grown restless. It was time to move on. He'd made a silent vow to track down Chapa Gonzalez and his gang. From Father Hayes, he learned that Chapa Gonzalez was a respected member of the community. Nathan also learned the location of Gonzalez's ranch. The nuns and priests of Loreto genuinely hated to see Nathan go, and he felt a real sense of loss as he saddled the bay. He had known better than to offer them money for their compassion and kindness, but from his saddlebag he had taken 10 gold double eagles. On his way down the hall, he had ducked quickly into the study, opened the center drawer of Father Hayes' desk, and left the gold coins there. Nathan followed the rutted Santa Fe trail on into town. Finding a telegraph office, he addressed the telegram to Foster Hagerman, Dodge City, Kansas. His message was brief.
Alive in Santa Fe, stop. Unfinished business, stop. Tell Melanie we'll see her in time for Christmas, stop. Stone.
From there, he rode until he found a livery and hotel, where he bought a copy of the local newspaper, wondering if he might find something in it about Chapa Gonzalez. It complicated things, learning that Gonzalez was apparently a respected member of the community. Obviously, he couldn't turn to the law for help, for he had absolutely no proof that Gonzalez was a thief and a killer. The man might be prominent enough to turn the law against Nathan, forcing him to ride out of New Mexico with a price on his head. He found himself with just one course of action. If Gonzalez was to be brought to justice, then it would have to be a one-man vendetta. Nathan arose at first light, found a cafe, and after breakfast, sought a mercantile. As it was still early, the store had just opened.
Partner, I'm needing a few sticks of dynamite, some caps, and fuses.
I ain't got much. Dynamite's mostly used for mining, and nearly all that's farther south. 12 sticks is all I got. Would that help?
I'll make do. Put it in a burlap sack if you have one.
Nathan tied the sack behind his saddle and rode south to let the storekeeper and others who might have seen him think he had ridden toward the distant mines. Once he was well away from town, he circled around and rode eastward. He had no real plan as to what he would do, and the dynamite was an ace in the hole should the Gonzalez Ranch actually be an impregnable stronghold. He suspected he was nearing the ranch when he came upon a clearly defined wagon road leading in from the northwest. If there were sentries, they most certainly would be watching the road, so he rode north for what he estimated was 3 miles. The land was becoming thick with cedar and fir, allowing Nathan to see without being seen. When he was at last able to see the ranch, he was astounded, for it sprawled for what seemed like half a mile. There were 2 long wings stretching from north to south, with a connecting link in the middle, like a huge letter H. Around the house and outbuildings, there was a stone wall of what might be unscalable proportions. The entrance was secured by an arched iron gate, and even from a distance, Nathan could see men moving about. He would have to wait for darkness, and even then would have to leave his horse a great distance away in the cover of trees. Rather than sit and wait, he rode northeast, circling the place. There was a back gate identical to the one at the front, including 2 armed sentries. After riding all the way around, he found not a single weakness in the massive wall. The only means of access other than the gates would be over the wall. Jutting above it at irregular intervals were stone uprights like spearheads. These he could rope from the ground to aid his climb. After riding into the hills north of Casa de la Gila, he rested, ate, and waited beside a spring. The sun went down, painting the western sky with plumes of crimson. The moon rose half full, and Nathan continued to wait until it had fully set. Once the lunar light was gone, the stars didn't seem to penetrate the darkness. He rode until the cedars began to thin, and he could see the massive stone walls ahead. Carefully, he picketed his horse so that the animal couldn't be seen, and far enough away so that if it nickered, it wouldn't reveal his presence.
Oh, steady, boy.
He capped the dynamite, attaching the estimated 45-second fuses. He divided the explosive, half of it in each end of the sack, and draped it around his neck. He decided against taking his Winchester, for he had no sling, and he would need both hands to hoist himself over the wall. Taking his lariat, he crept through the darkness toward the wall. It loomed black and forbidding, like something from a fairy tale, as he readied his loop. His first throw missed, but the second caught and held. The outer wall proved to be smooth, virtually impossible for him to gain any purchase with his boots, throwing all his weight on his arms and shoulders. There was intense pain in his side and in his upper back where he had been wounded, but he continued to struggle up the rope. Finally, exhausted and drenched with sweat, he sat on the wall. He looped his rope over the stone upright and descended to the ground. He made his way toward the house. Nathan crept to a window and beheld a table laden with food and drink. Men drank directly from bottles, and there were women in various stages of undress. Chapa Gonzalez was not among the revelers. Nathan crept around the house. While he wished to account for the entire gang, it was his intention to get Gonzalez first. Oddly, except for the hall with the merrymaking, there were no more lighted windows. Nathan moved on, pausing when he saw a flicker of light against a windowpane somewhere ahead of him. He was near the center hall that connected one side of the H to the other. He made his way past the window. Once beyond it, he came upon a door standing partially open. He quietly opened it further and stepped inside. Nathan froze.
Ah, senor. The good doctor told me the academy had taken in a man with gunshot wounds. Por Dios, it had to be you. I have the pistola ready, for I have been expecting you. This time, you will die.
Nathan dropped to the floor, firing at the muzzle flash. But Gonzalez was firing over the back of a couch, and Nathan's slugs went deep into the upholstery. He rolled up against the back of the couch, and to his surprise, the burly Gonzalez launched himself over the back of it. Nathan was knocked to the floor, dropping his colt, and the blade of a knife ripped through the collar of his shirt, narrowly missing his throat. He seized both of Gonzalez's arms and tried to buck him off, but Gonzalez had a weight advantage. Beneath him, Nathan could feel the colt he had dropped. With his left hand, he let go of Gonzalez and grabbed the colt. Swinging it as hard as he could, he slammed it into Gonzalez's head. Nathan shoved Gonzalez off and seized the knife. He was about to drive it into Gonzalez when the others arrived. Nathan fired, driving the first man back into one of his comrades. Nathan used the few seconds he had gained to get the couch between him and the door, barely in time to avoid a rain of lead.
Madre de Dios! Stop! Stop!
But his drunken followers did not stop, and Chapa Gonzalez died under their guns. Nathan's eyes had grown accustomed to the darkened room, and on hands and knees he crept along the wall toward the shadowy outline of another door. There were shouts of rage as the renegades fired through the door into the darkness into which Nathan had disappeared, their lead smashing into walls. Nathan made his way back toward the front of the house. The outlaws had left their women when the shooting had started. Now Nathan stepped into the room, a colt in each hand and Gonzalez's bowie knife under his belt. Nathan responded by shooting out all three lamps. Burning oil set fire to the deep carpet and sweeping velvet drapes. The commotion scattered the women and brought the renegades into the room on the run. Nathan lit a stick of dynamite and threw it among them. He threw a second stick. Every man was down. Whether dead or wounded, Nathan didn't know. The fire promised to burn the place to the ground, and such a conflagration wouldn't go unnoticed. One of the fleeing women had managed to unlock the gate. Nathan made his way there, retraced his steps to his horse, and rode north. Topping a rise, he turned and looked back. The entire house was afire, shooting sparks and orange flames heavenward. Certainly there would be an investigation, and Chapa Gonzalez would be mourned for the man he was believed to have been. Nathan had but one regret, which was that Gonzalez couldn't have been revealed for the thief and murderer he had been, and made to suffer disgrace as the result of it. He rode all night, occasionally resting the bay, and by dawn he was 70 miles away. Pueblo, Colorado, December 14, 1874. Nathan told Pueblo's Sheriff Brody what had happened.
I reckon if word ever gets out, I'll have a price on my head in New Mexico. But you see to it that the kin of those who died in that ambush know that the killers have paid.
I'll do that. And if you ever get in trouble as a result of it, you send me word. We'll bring enough people and raise enough hell till everybody west of the Mississippi knows the truth about Gonzalez and his gang.
I'm obliged.
Dodge City, Kansas, December 16th, 1874. Nathan opened the door of Hagerman's office at the AT&SF Railroad.
I don't have an appointment.
Oh, my God, we thought you were a goner. I eventually got a full report from the dispatcher in Pueblo about the posse being ambushed. Then, when we got the word, you had gone after the outlaws alone.
It took me a while.
He then told Hagerman the whole story, from the time he had first jumped the outlaws to the death of Chapa Gonzalez and the destruction of his empire.
You should never have taken on a task like that by yourself. The mine owners will bless you, the AT&SF will bless you, but it's a miracle you're alive.
I reckon. But that's my last official act for the AT&SF. I want to go somewhere with Melanie where there's no trains, no outlaws, no payrolls.
Oh, I wish I didn't have to tell you this, but Melanie Gavin is gone. We last heard from you on November 10th, and December 1st she left, believing you were dead. Said she was going to Columbus, Ohio, that she's got kin there. I'm sorry to see you go, and I was sorry to see Melanie leave without giving it some time. I hope you'll go on to Columbus and track her down.
No, I reckon we'd just be postponing her grieving. This time I came out of it forked end down. The next time, I might not, and she'd be going through it all over again. I'm obliged to you for your kindness to her, and for standing by me. If you're ever needing a friend, somebody to watch your back, get word to me.
I'll do that. And if your back's ever in need of watching, remember, you have friends here in Dodge.
Nathan checked out of the Dodge house and went to the livery for his pack horse and the Grulla. He then rode south. He was tired, his latest wound still bothered him, and he wanted solitude. He rode by the bank and found that Melanie had taken only $100 of the money he had left her, which was probably her fare back to Ohio. Nathan still had the $4,000 he'd won in Uvalde, plus his earnings from the railroad, so he wasn't hurting for money. It had been more than 2 years since he had been to New Orleans, and he longed to go there to spend some time with his friends, Barnabas and Bess McQueen. New Orleans, January 10th, 1875. Nathan rode down familiar streets, passing the St. Charles Hotel where he'd first met Byron Silver. He rode down a quiet lane toward the McQueen place. Cotton Blossom had most loved to come here, and Nathan had a lump in his throat and a tear in his eye as he thought about it. As he neared the house, McQueen's hounds made themselves known. Three of them were younger versions of one of the females, and the lot of them seemed about to eat Nathan alive.
Nathan! Oh, get down, all of you! This is Nathan! I'll go to the barn with you and help you unsaddle. Where's Cotton Blossom?
Briefly and painfully, Nathan told him.
We'll miss him. Later, when you've rested and we've had supper, maybe I'll have a surprise for you.
Nathan! Oh, go on in, I'll bring you some coffee. Supper will be ready shortly.
I'm counting on that. I've been eating my own cooking ever since I left Dallas.
Bring Cotton Blossom in, I'll feed him in the kitchen.
Cotton Blossom won't be coming in, Bess. He's gone to meet his maker.
I'm sorry to hear that. He was a fine one. Barnabas, have you told him?
After supper. He's likely starved, and I know I am.
Nathan told him of some of his months with the railroad, avoiding any mention of his brief relationship with Melanie Gavin. He concluded with his ill-fated pursuit of Chapa Gonzalez and his gang, of his recuperation at Loreto Academy in Santa Fe, and finally of the destruction of Gonzalez and his empire.
Nathan, there must be something you can do where you aren't always getting shot.
Well, Bess, it seems to just come with the territory.
Oh, hold on, Nathan. There's a scrap going on out there. I'll be right back.
Barnabas went out and broke up the dogs, and when he returned, a hound trotted in ahead of him. Nathan lost his grip on his coffee cup.
What in?
I reckon you know who his pappy was.
My God, another 6 months and he'll be...
Another Cotton Blossom.
When Nathan approached this younger version of the departed Cotton Blossom, the dog bared his teeth.
He's a strange one, though. There was four in the litter, and you've seen the other three. Bess calls him Empty because he never seems to get enough to eat. She's been feeding him inside because the others gang up on him every opportunity.
Well, he's not afraid of them?
God, no. Just the opposite. He'll leave his food to fight him. He goes off and hunts. Sometimes he'll be gone for 3 days. If you can make friends with him, I think he might make you a good traveling companion.
Well, there'll never be another Cotton Blossom. It wouldn't be fair to this one because I'd always be comparing him.
Oh, he'll measure up. And somehow, I think he's been waiting for you, even though he doesn't realize it.
I feel the same way. He accepts us, but that's as far as he'll go. I think he's been waiting for something else. If you let him get to know you, I think he'll have found what he's been waiting for.
Nathan began trying to make friends with Empty, and although the dog was no longer hostile, neither was he friendly. For the lack of anything better to do, Nathan began walking the fields and the bayous that surrounded the McQueen place. On one such walk, he turned to find Empty looking at him from the underbrush. The dog quickly was gone, and Nathan didn't see him again the rest of the day. Eventually, Nathan could count on seeing Empty at some point during his daily walks, and he believed the dog was watching for him. One afternoon, as Nathan was walking, he thought he heard Empty in the brush. He remained where he was, waiting for the dog, only to be confronted suddenly by three wild hogs. They broke toward him like greased lightning. He shot two of them, and the third escaped, but he was unaware of a fourth one. He charged him from behind, only to run headlong into Empty. The dog fought like a demon, and Nathan dared not shoot lest he hit Empty. The fight ended when the wild hog gave up and vanished into the underbrush. Bleeding from a mass of cuts, Empty tried to rise but couldn't. Both his front legs were mangled and bleeding. Nathan took a step forward, and when the dog's eyes met his own, he knew Empty wasn't going to bite him. He began with a hand on the bloody head, ruffling the dog's ears.
Good boy. Let's get you where we can help you.
Yeah. Then, as gently as he could, he lifted Empty and began the long walk back to the McQueen house. He was forced to stop and rest often, for the dog was heavier than he looked. The McQueen saw him coming and waited for him on the porch.
We met some wild hogs. I shot two of them. Another was about to tear into me from behind. Empty fought him, and I'm not sure yet who won.
I'll get blankets, hot water, and some medicine, and you can doctor him here on the porch. Barnabas, you'd better find a box for him and put it behind the stove. With him injured, he can't stay outside. His brothers will kill him while he can't defend himself.
Judging from what I saw him do today, I don't reckon they'd find it an easy task. But he does need to heal a mite before he jumps into another fracas.
Using the medicines best provided, Nathan patched up the dog as best he could. The wild hog's fangs had gone deep into Empty's front legs. Nathan drenched the wounds in alcohol. He then applied healing salve and bandaged them. Other wounds were treated in a similar manner, but without bandages. Barnabas came from the barn with a large wooden box, and Bess lined it with blankets.
Now, old son, you're going to enjoy 2 weeks of rest, whether you like it or not.
He lifted Empty into the box, and with Barnabas helping, they carried the box into the kitchen and placed it behind the stove. One side of the wooden box was lower than the others, and it was there that Bess placed a pan of water and food. Empty gulped down the food and chased it with most of the water.
Well, nothing bothers his appetite.
Well, by the time he's up and about, Nathan, you'll have yourself a dog.
Every day for a week, Nathan changed the bandages on Empty's front legs until the wounds had healed. By then, the dog was restless.
Your daddy will be hard to replace, but old son, I have the feeling you'll give him a run for his money.
By the 1st of April, the grass had begun to green, and there were signs of an early spring. Empty began looking more and more like the departed cotton blossom, and after the incident with the wild hogs, the dog took to Nathan in a manner that, as Bess had predicted, seemed almost preordained. Nathan began saddling the Gruya, and with Empty trotting alongside, they roamed the fields and woods. The dog learned quickly to remain with the horse upon command. In fact, Empty learned all of Cotton Blossom's old commands. The pointing of a finger would send him on ahead, or the way he had come, scouting the back trail. With Colt and Winchester, Nathan fired from many positions until Empty became comfortable with the sound of the weapons. The first week in April, a letter came addressed to Nathan in care of Barnabas McQueen. There was no return address, and when Nathan opened it, there was a single paragraph.
Need your help. Meet me in St. Louis at Pioneer Hotel, April 15th. Silver.
Nathan passed it to Barnabas, and Bess read it with him.
Sounds serious. You'll have to take a steamboat to reach St. Louis by the 15th.
No, I aim to. If I know Byron Silver, he's already there. And since he's expecting me to dance, I'm going to learn as much about the fiddlers as I can.
Orleans, April 8th, 1875. When the steamboat pulled into the landing, Hempty jumped like he'd been shot.
You better get used to that, partner. There'll be 3 days aboard this one, and St. Louis will be full of them.
The ship's officer was greeting passengers as they came aboard, and he gave Empty a quizzical look. Nathan decided he would resolve the problem by seeking out the captain, Travis Guthrie.
We'll be traveling with you to St. Louis, and when I take my meals, I want to have my dog fed. I'll pay extra if need be.
That won't be necessary. I'll speak to the cooks, and if you will go to the dining room half an hour early, both of you will be served.
Nathan proceeded to his assigned cabin, Empty at his heels. As the steamboat departed, this time, the dog didn't flinch. St. Louis, Missouri, April 11th, 1875. Nathan had been to St. Louis often enough to know his way around, and after 3 days aboard the steamboat, he felt like walking. Reaching the hotel, Nathan approached the desk. The clerk looked at the register after Nathan had signed and presented him with a key, telling him that all charges had been guaranteed for the length of his stay. The hotel had 3 floors, and Nathan's room was 21. He wondered if that had been intentional on Silver's part, since 21 was his code with the government. Nathan unlocked the door and found the room more elegant than anything he would have taken for himself. Instead of a single chair, there was a fancy couch, and beside the bed, a bell cord which would summon a bellboy. The broad dresser had brass drawer pulls and a wide mirror, which wasn't cracked. That alone was a novelty on the frontier. The bed was larger than most, with a fancy maroon and gold counterpane. There were maroon drapes at the window and plush carpet on the floor. On the dresser was an elaborate menu for the restaurant downstairs.
Fancy diggings for a wandering gun thrower. Government doesn't cut any corners.
After supper, Nathan removed his boots, hat, and gun belt and stretched out on the bed. He had been tempted to inquire at the desk about Silver, but changed his mind, for he had no idea what kind of security was involved. Nathan was dozing when Empty let him know there was someone outside the door.
Identify yourself.
21.
Silver! How'd you know I was at the McQueen's place?
It took me 2 telegrams to track you down. I wired Hagerman in Dodge and learned you had quit the railroad. After that, I played a hunch and telegraphed Captain Ferguson at Fort Worth. My God, that dog looks enough like old Cotton Blossom to be his son.
That's exactly who he is. I have one of McQueen's dogs to thank. He answers to Empty, and he owes that to Bess McQueen. Sit down.
I reckon you're chomping at the bit to know why I asked you here.
To some degree. Yeah, but I was more interested in why you specified April 15th.
Because that's the day Treasury Secretary B.H. Bristow will be here. I've told him about you, and he insists on meeting you.
Well, I'll meet him, but for what purpose? Is he just being neighborly?
He has need of a man with your particular talents, and I recommended you highly.
Thanks. Who's going to be shooting at me besides those who already want me dead?
I'm not exactly sure. You'll have to talk to Bristow, but I'm fair to middling sure you'll be allowed to shoot back.
Well, that's another question. Why are you breaking trail for the Treasury? From what I've heard and read, they have agents of their own.
Of course they do, but this involves a conspiracy within the Treasury, and Bristow isn't entirely sure who to trust.
I'm reminded of the Crédit Mobilier scandal during President Grant's first term. Is this something similar to the Union Pacific fraud?
No, this is more complex, and could involve several hundred people in St. Louis, Chicago, and Milwaukee. You see, following the war, the government was in need of money. Liquor taxes were raised, in some cases up to 8 times the price of the liquor.
An almighty expensive tax.
I fully agree, but it's the law. And the distillers have been collecting the tax. The trouble is, the largest distillers in St. Louis, Chicago, and Milwaukee haven't been turning this tax over to the government. Government officials high and low have been bribed in order for these distillers to keep the collected taxes for themselves. This has been going on for a while. It's become a public scandal, in fact, but it's a political powder keg. The whiskey ring is considered impregnable because of its strong political connections. One of the prime suspects is President Grant's secretary, O.E. Babcock.
So this thing could destroy Grant.
It could. And it might. But Treasury Secretary Bristow intends to break the conspiracy, letting the political chips fall where they may. And there, my friend, is where you come in.
Hell, Silver, the war's been over nearly 10 years. How much money is at stake?
More than $3 million.
My God. Where could that much money be hidden?
Renegade bankers may be concealing some of it, but there's a chance that hundreds of thousands of dollars are being secreted in warehouses belonging to distilleries or their agents.
So this Secretary Bristow aims to find all this money, and he thinks I can help? How?
Simple answer is, by joining the ranks of the whiskey ring. But there's more involved than just recovering the money. Bristow wants to collect sufficient evidence to destroy this organization. He believes he can do this only by assigning secret investigators from outside the Treasury Department.
So I'm to be one of those investigators. I'm flattered, Silver, but what makes him think I'm qualified?
You're quick with your wits, your guns, and your fists. And there is absolutely no obvious connection between you and the Department of the Treasury. There is a possibility you may be called upon to rob one of the suspected banks.
No, by God.
Stone, you would in no way be operating outside the law. Several banks are believed to have double sets of books, the second containing illegal deposits belonging to a number of distilleries implicated in this conspiracy.
All that's going to get you is evidence of double dealing by some bankers. So a bank has a few hundred thousand that it can't account for legally. How do you aim to prove its whiskey taxes owed to the government?
Damn, I don't have all the answers. I offered to help, at least with the situation here in St. Louis. And I set up this meeting because I believed you were quick-witted enough, smooth enough, and tough enough to pull it off. I've given you some idea as to what Bristow has in mind without knowing his reasons. Do this. Wait until you talk to Bristow, and if he can't answer your questions to your satisfaction, then just tell him it's no deal. I made him no promises beyond asking you here for the meeting. Comprende?
Yeah. I'll wait and see what Bristow has to say.
St. Louis, Missouri, April 15, 1875. Despite himself, Nathan was impressed with B.H. Bristow. He had gray hair, gray eyes, and a firm handshake. He wasted no time in outlining what he had in mind.
We already have undercover agents at work in Milwaukee and Chicago, Stone, and I'm especially eager to have you in charge of our investigation here in St. Louis. I must say that I'm impressed with what Mr. Silver has told me about you. However, it is up to you as to whether you wish to become involved in this operation. I trust that Silver has introduced you to the problem and possibly some of the means by which we're hoping to resolve it.
He has, and I'm flattered, but I'm not sure that I'm qualified as an investigator. As I understand it, there are no rules. You'll be dependent on me to come up with evidence against people involved in this whiskey ring when I have no way of knowing what you consider evidence. Why don't you spell out what you're expecting me to do, and I'll consider it.
Very well. There are two distilleries here. One of them is operated by Woodard Slaughter, and the other by P.V. Honemeyer. Both are involved in this tax fraud. And if we can get the goods on one of them, we can convict them both. It's Mr. Silver's belief that with our help, you can ingratiate yourself with one or both of these men and work your way into their operations. From such a vantage point, you can observe them, and you'll be in a position to secure the evidence we need.
Or get myself shot graveyard dead.
I won't deny that's a possibility, because Slaughter and Honemeyer have surrounded themselves with gunmen. But rest assured you won't be alone. While Mr. Silver is unable to join you undercover, he and a force of agents will monitor your every move.
If you get shot, so will I.
That makes me feel some better.
Then you'll work with us?
Yes.
Good. Now here's how we'll get you on the good side of Slaughter and Honemeyer. Many people don't know this, but Slaughter and Honemeyer are actually brothers-in-law. Their wives are younger women, and they're under the protection of armed men 24 hours a day. These ladies are going to be abducted, Mr. Stone, and while no harm will come to them, Slaughter and Honemeyer won't be aware of that. I expect them to offer substantial rewards for the return of their wives. You, Mr. Stone, are going to rescue these ladies at the risk of your life. With the cooperation of the local authorities and a contrived newspaper story, you will be credited with the killing of the abductors. That should quickly get you into the good graces of our distillers.
Just as quickly adding to my reputation as a fast gun, increasing my chances of being gunned down by some varmint looking for a name at my expense.
Not necessarily. Slaughter and Honemeyer have some of the best lawyers money can buy, and they'll leave no stone unturned to avoid any unfavorable publicity.
I reckon that'll be a mite difficult with the story in the newspaper.
Men who can buy lawyers can buy newspapermen, too. You'll just have to take my word for it that Slaughter and Honemeyer will keep the affair as quiet as they can.
There's a reason for that. Let the word get out that they're being hit for reward money for the return of their women, and they'll be fair game for every thief and outlaw in Missouri.
Exactly. We'll see that they're allowed to hush this up. We'll depend on you, Mr. Stone, to pull off a convincing rescue. The abductors, of course, will be my agents, and they must die convincingly when you appear to shoot them. Mr. Silver will see that you are given blank cartridges for your pistols.
For one pistol, Mr. Bristow. I won't go anywhere with both my weapons loaded with blanks. Not for you, not for Silver here, not even for the president.
One pistol loaded with blanks, Secretary Bristow. You'll just have to depend on Senor Stone to remember which cult has live shells.
Very well. Do you have any more questions, Stone?
Yeah, with all the secrecy, how am I supposed to know about any of this? How do you know Slaughter and Honemeyer won't turn to the Pinkertons?
Because they suspect we've had the Pinkertons after them. They'll go to the law because they believe they have friends there. One of those friends will supposedly pass the word on to you. After we've allowed them to sweat for a few days, you will then rescue the ladies and impress Slaughter and Honemeyer. Don't accept the reward money they'll offer you, and don't seem anxious to hire out to them.
Suppose they don't hire me?
It is a calculated risk, but my men are going to make you look damn good in front of the abducted ladies, and I'm counting on them to influence their husbands.
Well, I don't like traveling under false colors.
It's for the good of the country.
So the country can collect 8 times the price of a bottle of whiskey. You're just damn lucky I don't drink the stuff unless I've been shot.
If you're shot, I'll see that you get your whiskey for free. Good evening, Mr. Stone.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Secretary, I'll see you to the door.
Well, this just seems like a flimsy, damn fool way of going after evidence, and I'm doing this only as a favor to you.
Well, thanks. I consider that a tribute to our friendship. Frankly, I'm not all that concerned about the financial state of the country. I am a little sorry for President Grant because I don't think he's involved in this, and the only way to spare him and his office is to root out the guilty varmints.
I reckon you're right. With Grant's friends and kin, the man sure as hell doesn't need any enemies.
2 weeks later, Silver came to Nathan with news that the abduction had taken place.
Annie Slaughter and Myrtle Honemeyer are being held in a deserted warehouse across the river in East St. Louis. The gunmen Slaughter and Honemeyer hired to protect the women were really Bristow's men. The abduction has been reported, but just as Bristow expected, it's being kept quiet. So far, these big spenders are each offering a $500 reward.
I reckon they're saving that whiskey tax for their old age. When do I make this damn fool rescue?
Bristow says give it another week, during which no progress will be made on the search. We can't have it look too easy. I'll be back in your play and covering you as you work on the rescue.
East St. Louis, Illinois, June 2nd, 1875. Silver, Nathan, and Empty watch the deserted warehouse from a distance.
The warehouse door is locked. To make this look good, you'll have to bust out a window and gun down the two abductors.
And what am I to do with these ladies after I've rescued them?
Mount them on the horses that belong to their abductors and take them to the local sheriff's office. Sheriff Rainey has been sworn to secrecy and he'll send for Slaughter and Honemeyer. When they arrive, you're on your own. Remember, the objective is to make them want to hire you to replace the gunman who allowed Annie and Myrtle to be kidnapped. Just become the hard-nosed bastard you're capable of being.
Nathan's face hardened into a scowl and he dropped his right hand to the butt of his Colt.
Is that the one loaded with blank cartridges?
No. It's the other one. Empty, you stay here.
Nathan approached the old warehouse alone, coming at it from one end where there were no windows. Reaching a corner of the building, Nathan kept his back against the wall, advancing toward the window designated by Silver. There was glass on the ground, evidence that some of the panes had been broken. The sun had slipped beneath the western horizon, and shadows were beginning to shroud the land. It was supper time, and the first bold stars shot forth their rays across the deep purple of the darkening sky. The remaining window panes were dirty, and at first Nathan could see nothing. But then he saw them. The women sat on a wooden plank supported by two kegs, their backs to the window. Their abductors stood a few paces away, revolvers in their hands, making a good show of it. Nathan kicked the window in, and when the men whirled to face him, he drew the Colt loaded with blanks. The women looked on in horror as the two men fell, apparently shot dead. Nathan stepped through the empty window frame, the smoking Colt still in his hand. Annie Slaughter and Myrtle Hohenmeyer were young and were expensively dressed. Nathan wouldn't have considered either of them beautiful. After the initial shock, they didn't seem afraid of him.
Miss Hohenmeyer? Mrs. Slaughter?
I'm Myrtle Hohenmeyer, and this is Annie Slaughter. Who are you?
There's horses outside. Come on, we're going to the sheriff's office.
Unbarring the door, he led them to the picketed horses.
Sir, we're not dressed for riding. It would be indecent.
I reckon you can stand it just this once.
Both women were slight, and seizing Annie, Nathan sat her astraddle of a roan horse. Before Myrtle could voice a similar protest, he sat her down in the saddle of a dun. Both women tried vainly to get their skirts down. Annie tried unsuccessfully to dismount and started to fall head first. Nathan caught her and hoisted her back into the saddle, her face flaming.
Ah, damn it, Annie Slaughter. You're going to ride that horse if I have to rope you belly down across the saddle. Is that clear?
She said nothing more, and whatever Myrtle Hohenmeyer might have wanted to say, she had second thoughts and remained silent. By the time the trio crossed the river, it was dark enough that nobody noticed the indecently mounted riders with skirts working themselves above their knees. Nobody spoke a word until they reached the sheriff's office. Empty wisely remained in the shadows, while Nathan helped the women to dismount and presented them at the sheriff's office. Rainey had been waiting for them, although he did a good job of acting surprised.
Sheriff, this ruffian manhandled us.
Is that a fact? I don't recall the last time a gent manhandled a woman and then brought her to the sheriff's office.
Sorry, but they weren't dressed for riding, and from where I found them, it was too far to walk. I manhandled them into their saddles and manhandled them to the ground when we got here.
Deputy Gibb, fetch Slaughter and Hohenmeyer. These ladies has had their dignity bruised a mite, but they don't seem hurt. Far as the law is concerned, the case is closed.
Well, I never! Such gross incompetence and impudence!
Ladies, have a seat. Your husband should be here shortly.
Slaughter and Hohenmeyer arrived, and they looked like what they were. Both were in their 50s, gone to fat and partially bald. They were dressed in expensive town clothes, and rather than going immediately to their wives, they turned to Sheriff Rainey.
Sheriff, thank you.
Oh, I had nothing to do with this. There's the hombre you want, and I don't even know his name.
Nathan Stone.
He kept his thumbs hooked in his belt and said no more.
I'm P.V. Hohenmeyer, and this is Woodard Slaughter. My office is nearest. We can talk there.
He steered Myrtle toward the door, and Slaughter followed with Annie.
Good luck.
As Hohenmeyer had said, it wasn't far to his office. Once there, they wasted no time.
I suppose you want to claim the reward. I will write you a check, and Slaughter will write you a check, each for $500. You may cash them in the morning. Then you will leave town, and you will say nothing of this incident.
Keep your money. I reckon it'll mean more to you than it will to me. As for leaving town, I'll go when I'm damn good and ready, and I'm not ready.
Instead of running him out of town, you should hire him. He's better than any dozen of the men you had.
Woodard, Myrtle's right. He was magnificent. He shot those two ruffians before they could move.
I have seen Mr. Stone somewhere before, and I believe it was on a Pinkerton wanted dodger. Do you deny it, Stone?
No, but it was all a misunderstanding.
It always is. But if you're on the bad side of the Pinkertons, I could learn to like you, Stone.
I couldn't do the same for you, not if you walked on water.
Nathan began to relax. The more he reviled them, the more they were drawn to him.
Stone, we could use a man like you. What's your price?
Well, I'm not for sale.
Every man's for sale.
Hohenmeyer, if I don't like a man, I don't care a damn if he's made of solid gold.
And you don't like me?
No.
What about me?
I figure both you buzzards roost on the same limb.
Nathan, turn to the women.
You ladies are fresh out of hired guns for protection, and those you had didn't impress me. Are you hiring?
Perhaps, but we had two of them. Who would be the other?
There is no other. I work alone.
The others were paid $500 a month. You will be paid no more.
I'll be paid no less. I'm replacing two men, and I'll be paid for two men. $1,000 a month.
Hell no!
Hell yes!
Peavy! We want him. Pay him what he's asking.
The first month in advance.
No. Damn it, we've only known you for an hour, and for all we know, you're a fugitive from the law.
I'm as clean as you and Honemeyer. I've proven myself. If that's not good enough, well, ladies, I'll be going.
I have my own funds. I'll write you a check. First month in advance.
I'll pay my share.
Annie!
After this, Peavy, Annie and I will remain together for our own protection. I will be at her place. Now, Mr. Stone, if you will be so kind as to escort us there, we'll be going.
After you, ladies. Good night, gentlemen.
They left the office, Nathan following. The moon had risen, and suddenly Empty appeared from the shadow of the roof's overhang.
Well, that's my dog, Empty. He goes where I go. I'm returning to the sheriff's office for my horse, and we'll go from there. Do you ladies aim to walk, or shall I manhandle you back into your saddles?
Oh, you can manhandle me back into the saddle. I believe you're the kind of man who's seen a woman's knees before.
Nathan suspected this pair wasn't nearly as helpless as they wished to appear. The two women and Nathan reined up before what seemed an enormous house on a dead-end street.
I'll see both of you inside, and then I'll see to the horses. Is there a stable?
Behind the house.
Annie produced a key and unlocked the front door. She lighted a lamp on a table in the hall.
Lock the door behind me. I'll knock when I return.
Oh, there are lanterns in the stable. Do you have matches?
Yes.
After taking care of the horses, Nathan had no choice except to return to Annie Slaughter's house. For some reason, he really didn't want to. On his way, he thought about the stable, which was large, befitting a man of Woodard Slaughter's obvious wealth, but there were no horses in it, and he wondered why. Empty followed Nathan into the big house.
Come on to the kitchen. There'll be coffee in a few minutes, and we are cooking supper. Or breakfast, I suppose. There'll be ham, eggs, and biscuits.
Nathan kicked a chair back against the wall and sat down. Empty sat beside him, eyes on the unfamiliar women.
Why is he looking at us like that?
Well, he doesn't know you, so he doesn't trust you.
And what about you?
That's a pretty good standard for a dog or man.
If we hadn't spoken up for you, you'd have just walked out without any reward, wouldn't you?
Yes, ma'am. I don't want money from a man who begrudges it. So I'm a mite choosy about who I work for.
Yet you'd work for us.
Why not? Do you believe you should be held accountable for all that Slaughter has done or failed to do?
I believe the coffee is ready.
Nathan's question went unanswered. After the meal, Annie rose.
I'll show you to your room, Mr. Stone.
I'd prefer that you call me Nathan.
Nathan, then.
Nathan and Empty followed her down a hall that led to another wing of the house. It had four rooms, and she led Nathan to the second one on the right.
Myrtle and I will be in the rooms across the hall.
What about this one next to me?
Nobody sleeps there. That's a storage room.
Nathan wondered where Woodard Slaughter slept. Did he occupy the room with Annie, or sleep in another wing of the house? He said nothing, but somehow he believed Slaughter had a room of his own, down some other hall. At the first opportunity, he would enter the room next to his to learn what was stored there.
I reckon I don't have to remind you and Myrtle to lock your bedroom doors every night?
No, but when we were abducted, we weren't taken from our beds.
Maybe I should be outside at night. I'm not sure it's proper, me being alone with two married ladies.
As your employers, that's our decision, not yours. We want you inside. This key that I'll give you fits your door and ours. Feel free to enter our rooms at any time, if you feel that there is cause.
It was an outrageous thing for a married woman to say, and it told Nathan a lot about the probable relationship these women had with their much older husbands. But he was less concerned with that than with the possibility that this same key might also unlock the storage room. Taking the key she offered, he stepped into his room. Empty followed. Nathan closed the door and tested the key in the lock. Satisfied that it worked, he left the door unlocked and waited. Soon he quietly opened the door again and looked out into the hall. At the far end where they had entered, a bracket lamp burned. Nathan tugged off his boots, stepped out into the hall, and went to the door of the storage room. Quickly he tried his key, but the lock held fast. He dropped the key in his pocket and returned to his room, elated over his discovery. Striking a match, he lit the lamp on the dresser. As he had approached the house, he had seen the high gables, suggestive of an attic. Carefully, he studied the ceiling and then took the lamp into the closet. There was no evidence of a trap door to the attic anywhere in the ceiling. Anytime he left his room, he must be careful, because he had no doubt that just as his key would unlock the doors to the rooms occupied by Annie and Myrtle, their keys would probably unlock the door to his room. He set the lamp on the table beside the bed and sat down in the room's only chair. Empty sat down on a throw rug, his eyes meeting Nathan's.
Damn it, Empty, we stacked the deck and everything looks good, but I got me a gut feeling that I could end up with a busted flush. Are these women what they seem? Or have they seen through Bristow's plan, pulling me in to keep an eye on me?
Tossing his hat on the dresser, Nathan hung his gun belt on the head of the bed. As he so often had done when faced with uncertainty, he blew out the lamp and stretched out on the bed, fully dressed. It was a long time before he slept.